Welcome to Time to Talk Science and Medicine. This podcast is brought to you by the Translational Institute of Medicine at Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name's Dr. Charlie Highmarch, and I'm an assistant professor and researcher at Queen's.
And my name is Stephen Archer. I'm a cardiologist and researcher here at Queen's, and I'm the director of the Translational Institute of Medicine, which we call TIME.
In this series, we are fortunate to talk science and medicine with some of the most accomplished translational researchers from Queen's University and beyond. We want to get to know what their dangerous idea is, which is a concept that they're working on which, if true, would change the direction of research or alter our understanding of medicine. We also want to find out about the person behind the discoveries. In previous podcasts, we sat down with clinicians and basic scientists from Queen's and beyond to discuss a diverse range of research topics, from cancer research to studies of cardiovascular disease, bleeding disorders, and the impact of animal care on both human and animal well-being. We've even discussed particle physics with a Nobel laureate and healthcare reform with a former dean.
Today, I'm very excited that we have Dr. Karen Yates in the studio. Karen is a nephrologist and a professor of medicine at Queen's University and is the co-director of the Medical School's Office of Global Health. Over the years, I've been so impressed with Dr. Yates' work in Tanzania, where she's really done something quite unusual, which is championed cancer care for Tanzanian women. And we're going to hear more about that on this podcast. But what's interesting to me, of course, is that cervical cancer, which is what Dr. Yates studies, is caused by a virus. And the 2008 Nobel Prize was given to Zurhausen and Montagnier. Zurhausen discovered human papillomavirus and its role in cervical cancer, causing that disease. And Montagnier discovered the HIV virus. And interestingly, Dr. Yates's work is preventing cervical carcinoma in women that have human papillomavirus, and the condition is much more prevalent in those that also have the HIV virus. So kind of an interesting Nobel Prize follow-up. So before we hear all about your science and your dangerous idea, Dr. Yates, can you tell us about yourself and your origin story? How did you wind up at Queen's University as an eminent nephrologist who somehow studies cervical cancer in Tanzanian women?
Sure, and thank you both for having me here. So I guess I'll start right at the very beginning. I was born in Toronto, adopted into a wonderful family as an infant. And all through high school, I was lucky enough to go to a school for a Catholic all-girls school that actually had a focus on what was STEM. We didn't know it at the time, but really, really influenced my interest in science and being a scientist. And I went to the Canada-wide Science Fair twice, which they had a lot of students who were able to do that. My project was on spatial memory in mice. Don't ask me what it was about. I forget. But I left that high school and went to McGill and did anatomy and cell biology as an undergraduate honors degree. And actually, at a late stage, later than most students decide these days, I thought to myself, oh, maybe I would like to be a physician. And I scrambled in the last year and a half of my undergraduate degree and doing my MCATs and all those things, and I applied to medicine. And I ended up at Queen's. And then at Queen's, I did med school, or Meds 97. We're having our reunion in June, kind of off cycle from homecoming. And I went from Queen's. I was very interested in, I guess, the complicated nature of the human body. And I went on to do internal medicine in Toronto. I actually had a baby during that time, and I chose to do a fourth year as a chief year, which was a chief resident year, which was funded separately. So I was able to take that time with my two going on 3 year old. And then I came to Queen's to do nephrology. And Queen's didn't have a program actually at the time I was considering nephrology. But I was lucky enough in the year prior to my application for subspecialty training, they had developed a program, and it was developed by one of my mentors from undergrad, from med school. So they convinced me to come and be a part of, I was going to stay in Toronto. They convinced me to come to Queen's, where I'd be in a program of one of two nephrology fellows and where I could have that space to learn. And during my nephrology training, I actually had another baby, but I crammed all of my clinical training into the first 14 months so that I could apply for a scholarship in the Department of Medicine known as the John Alexander Stewart Scholarship, and I went to Harvard and did my master's, and that's where I got the foundation of my research training.
That's interesting, because we still give out the John Alexander Stewart Scholarship.
Every time they announce it, I think about it.
It's a great career development tool. Sometimes the people go on to faculty like you, not always, but that's a very forward-looking investment in people going abroad to learn something so they come back improved. So I'm glad to see that that started early and is still yielding fruit.
Yes, that's true. And so while I was in Boston with a newborn doing my coursework for my master's, I got really interested in global health at the time and health disparities. I had terrific professors in that area. And during that time, someone in nephrology, my same mentor in nephrology, Ted Toffelmeyer, reached out to me and along with the head of the Department of Medicine, and asked, they said they were hiring a new nephrologist position and would I consider applying? And I did. And that's how I ended up at Queen's University in the Division of Nephrology over 20 years ago.
And who was the head that time?
It was John McCanns.
Yeah. Very good. I'm sure he'd be happy to know that his instrumental role in your career here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then I came here and it's the rest is sort of history. Started as an assistant professor, and over the last 20 years I've moved up to full professor and developed my research program, but continued to be a clinician as well.
And do you think that the trip to Boston or the time in Boston was really what got you interested in global health as opposed to conventional in Canada medicine?
Yes. Harvard has an amazing, at the school, I did an MPH with a research focus. I did a minor in global health, and what is now the Harvard T-Chan School of Public Health had an incredible division, which I think stands separately now, that was in humanitarian medicine and global health. They still have a very strong footprint in global health. And it was through those courses and electives I was able to take during my master's that I really got interested in health disparities and research in that area.
It's funny, I talk to undergraduate students a lot about their career options and their planning, and they've got a lot of anxiety and all this is set plan. And I say to them, sometimes life just kind of happens to you and you end up finding that the thing that you're passionate about was something that you'd never considered doing. And of course, public health and nephrology, there are probably parallels there, but mm-hmm. there were certainly differences in your career, right?
Definitely, definitely. And what I actually struggled a little bit with after I started at Queen's, of course, you're learning how to kind of run a practice, be part of an academic group practice, be in charge, you know, be the attending physician. And I also, you know, was trying to start a research program. That's hard when you first start out. And how would I make, build collaborations and partnerships in places around the world? So what I did was I actually joined an organization in Ottawa that worked in East and West Africa. They were working on primary care and HIV care, and we kind of weaseled my way in, and the director of that organization, they're called Canada Africa Community Health Alliance. They're still around. I ultimately ended up on their board of directors for some time. The director of CASHA was an HIV physician in Ottawa. At University of Ottawa, and also within the city, I think caring for many people living with HIV, and Don Kilby's his name. And Don was going to Tanzania, I would say like on a logistical trip to, because there was, in the partnerships that he had, there was an area on a whole community of about 300,000 people on Mount Kilimanjaro that had no access to HIV care. And he was great at getting philanthropic money and donors to build things and develop programs. And I went with him and his team in 2006. My husband came with me, actually. I used vacation time. And I learned that from him the steps in, you know, developing a program like this. That HIV clinic still stands. And we do our cervical cancer screening in that clinic up in a little village called Kilema. I've lived at the hospital there with my family. In 2007, I went back. And that's how Then I just started moving on and meeting people, and I went to the Academic Health Science Center that's based in Kilimanjaro region, and just sought opportunities and partnerships out to work on things that I felt were important.
And we'll get to your sort of dangerous idea and what you did in Tanzania, but before that, I mean, there's a couple of interesting parts to your story. One, you and all the other nephrologists have been involved, and members of the Department of Medicine, with Moose Factory, so you sort of done what I would consider like global health at home.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a long history of Queen's University physicians going up north.
Yes.
And I'm not sure whether that preceded your Harvard experience or was just another factor in your interest in global health.
That's a really good point. And it was something that I didn't want to forget to bring up today, is that as a nephrology fellow, I was able to go up to Moose Factory, and it was actually right around the time that they were really lobbying and pushing to get a hemodialysis unit up there, because at that time people had to come to Kingston and relocate from their communities. And then when I became a full-fledged nephrologist at Queen's, I took on that role of being, we used to alternate at times, but it became kind of my satellite area that I would go to see patients, because we developed a regional program to bring hemodialysis care closer to home for people in southeastern Ontario. So it just over time became sort of my satellite, and then I was adding in clinic days and doing research in partnership with the Indigenous colleagues up there.
So it seems that you accumulated quite a lot of experience working with Indigenous communities, and that presumably translated nice to working in Tanzania.
Yeah, it felt, I said to my husband once, it might even been the first trip or possibly the second trip in 2007 when we took our then 3.5-year-old and our 7.5-year-old, and I was grateful to be given some time. I think a combination of vacation time and some unpaid leave and some academic time, and we went to Tanzania for four or five months. And when I got off the plane, it must have been that second trip, I said to my husband, you know, I feel at home here, and I think it's because I work in the north. It felt there's very similar issues with struggling with low resources and healthcare, and if you think about it, Tanzania was colonized similar to the way our Indigenous people are, and those remnants and trauma and issues from that still exist.
One thing that listeners to the podcast may not be aware of, but Dr. Yates has mentioned time a couple of times, and it is interesting that in many academic medicine programs, there is a clinical demand on physicians' time that really makes it difficult to do anything other than clinical medicine and clinical-related research at home. And a sort of a big shout-out to the Department of Medicine and an agency called SEAMO, S-E-A-M-O, which is our funding organization, which allows people in the clinical track that Dr. Yates is in, which is clinician-scientist, to be able to have time to go and either into a laboratory here in Kingston or to go abroad and do the research. And that's a unique feature that allows academic physicians to really thrive. And it never feels like there's enough time, but at least it means they're paid while they're doing research or are able to do things other than just patient care, which is very important, but is not the only thing a university professor is supposed to be doing.
Absolutely.
That's my unpaid advertisement. So SEAMO, send me some money and send me some love.
I absolutely 100% agree, and it's critical. And I get, I have former residents and students that I've mentored who are now off in various jobs at academic centers or in the community as cardiologists and nephrologists, and they reach out to me fairly regularly asking how they can develop a research program given that they want to, but that they have so much clinical demand on their time.
Okay, so that's quite a nice segue to what we wanted to talk about in our next question. When we chatted before this podcast, you described yourself as the first nephrologist in Kilimanjaro, and I quite like that. But then, of course, the conversation moved to a topic that was outside of that discipline. So my first question for you is, we like to talk about dangerous ideas, which are ideas really that would disrupt the field of study. So what's your dangerous idea?
Okay, so I'm going to give you a quick segue into how I got to the dangerous idea, because it'll make sense to folks listening. So I started out to building my research program in Kilimanjaro around prevention of chronic kidney disease, which is finding strategies to improve diagnosis and management of things like high blood pressure and diabetes, which are huge issues in a very rapidly transitioning population like Tanzania. I was working on that. I found a young physician at the Kilimanjaro Christian Medical Center. We linked with the International Society of Nephrology. He was able to get kidney training, and now he's building his program there. But aside from that, we decided, I was his mentor, and he was my mentee, we decided we would apply for grants to start doing some research around prevention of chronic kidney disease. And we managed to get a team grant from CIHR that was using a mobile health strategy, a smartphone-based strategy, to train nurses and community health workers to diagnose and manage high blood pressure. During that time, when I was over there working on that grant with him, I was rounding on the hospital wards in this very large, like 900-bed Academic Health Science Center hospital in Kilimanjaro. And we didn't have our hemodialysis program, but we had a low-tech program to provide a few weeks of dialysis to people who would recover their kidney function. And he brought me to the female ward, where there were women there who had kidney failure because they had advanced cervical cancer that had spread through their pelvis into the bladder and other things. And of course, we couldn't provide dialysis, this low-tech dialysis and short-term dialysis to them in our program because they were dying. And I said to him, like, I don't know when I've seen a woman die of cervical cancer in Canada. It's so rare. And he said, well, Prof, you guys have public, you know, population-based screening programs. We don't have pap smears here. We don't have these things. And that's when I started down that pathway. And I went to the clinic, the reproductive health clinic that day, and spoke with Dr. Oneko, Olola Oneko, who was a gynecologist, who, when I actually walked into the clinic, was in a clinic room. And he explained who I was. I think Kajiru introduced us, and he invited me in, and he was training a group of nurses to do cervical cancer screening using a technique he'd learned in Zambia that involved a digital camera and allowing taking an image of the cervix to increase the resolution. It was called digital cervicography, very successful in Zambia. And I said to him, we could probably scale this program, evaluate it and scale this program in multiple rural areas that are hard to reach by using a smartphone. And so we applied for a grant to Grant Challenges Canada. And we got that grant, we did the proof of concept study, and then they gave us transition to scale funding. We developed our own mobile application. We called the program Smartphone Enhanced VIA, and VIA is the technique that nurses use. So they visualize the cervix during a pelvic exam, and they apply vinegar to the cervix, table vinegar or 5% acetic acid. And the lesions on the cervix that are cancerous or precancerous that can be treated to cure that woman and prevent her from having future cervical invasive cervical cancer, those lesions turn white. They call it aceto whitening. And that's what we worked on. We did a scale-up project. We screened thousands of women. We trained hundreds of nurses within the now growing national program on cervical cancer prevention. And this was a WHO guideline-based method, this VIA method. But over time, you know, more and more data was emerging that many countries who had developed these programs, even if using smartphones, they still had high morbidity and mortality rates from cervical cancer. This wasn't really making a dent. And it's because of the subjective nature of a human looking at a cervix and making decisions whether to treat with a thermal ablate, a little device where they zap off the lesions, or they can use cryotherapy. And so when that data was emerging and the WHO, the World Health Organization, evaluated the data around testing for human papillomavirus, whether tested by a health provider during a pap smear or a woman taking a sample from her vagina, there was tons and tons of evidence to show that knowing if a woman was infected with the HPV that causes cervical cancer, and there's 13 types, we call them oncogenic or high-risk types, knowing that was far more predictive than doing any of this visual inspection. And you could use the HPV result or the HPV genotype to then focus your resources on those women who were positive, and many who were living with HIV as well, who had a very high probability of having lesions, and you could do much better improved visual inspection and what we call colposcopy using other fancier devices, and you could treat lesions in those women to prevent future cancer.
I'm sure Dr. Zurhausen would be smiling because he fought the medical profession for years trying to prove that this virus, not all forms of which cause cervical cancer, but cervical cancer basically doesn't exist without this. So you're kind of setting the pretest probability that if you have positive serology or positive smear for this virus, then you're at risk of high risk of cervical cancer, and then those lesions and other factors become more interpretable than if you just get a cold.
Exactly. You increase your pretest probability. Yeah. And that leads now to the, I guess, more of the dangerous idea. So I had to convince my colleagues in Tanzania, it wasn't hard, but that we needed to move away from our smartphone technique that we developed, that they had actually incorporate it into their guidelines and tell them that, no, still not good enough. Now we need to move to HPV testing. We can have great population coverage if we can get community volunteers and community health workers and nurses in rural facilities to get women just to do a swab of their vagina. It looks like a COVID swab. It's painless, takes 30 seconds. And if we can test for HPV, then we can know which women we need to do further screening on. It's what we call VIA triage. And the WHO came out with these guidelines in 2021 for all countries, Canada down to low and middle income countries, saying that countries need to switch to HPV testing. It's so much superior and better. But many of these countries, HPV testing is expensive. It requires a big analyzer. It's $18 to $20 a test, whereas VIA was $1 a woman in some of our costing. You know, it's the nurse's time and the training. So that transition has been difficult. But our team that I'm part of now, which is through a National Institutes of Health, National Cancer Institute in the U.S., our team has been involved with a global effort, a global consortium, which we called Crowdsourcing to Cure Cervical Cancer. And it involved, during the pandemic, the team at the NIH worked closely to develop an HPV test that could be done in these locations, in the near point of care, in a village, in a small lab that would cost less than $5 or less. And they managed to take the time of the pandemic when we couldn't be out really doing anything in the field to work on the validation of that device, which ultimately is what has changed the paradigm for how countries can screen. And there's other devices that are now available. So in that group, we also thought, not just me, this is a group effort. Dr. Mark Schiffman and Dr. Sylvia de San Jose, who were the head of the consortium, had in their sights for their last phase of their career to develop an AI software that could take out the subjective nature of the nurse's decision in doing visual inspection, this triage, on women who are HPV positive. So providing the best quality follow-up screening you could do. And they knew this was possible. They were working with AI engineers from Harvard and University of Colorado. And there was some funding from NIH and from Gates Foundation. But we needed a huge amount of data to do this, to train neural networks and do deep learning algorithms. We anticipated we would need 100,000 women in this project, which would be HPV DNA genotyping on a woman, visual inspection, and then good quality photographic digital images of the cervix of that same woman, and then a biopsy of her cervix to show what actual disease is there so you can train the deep learning algorithm. We thought we would need, that's called the PAVE strategy, so the human papillomavirus automated visual evaluation strategy. We thought we'd need about 100,000 women, and we've managed to validate the deep learning algorithm with just over 35 or 40,000 women. And now we're on the next phases of what we call PAVE 2.0.
And the idea is, I presume, to use artificial intelligence so you don't need biopsies. The biopsies are to validate the model.
Exactly.
And then once you learn that that picture combined with this serology equals cervical cancer,
exactly.
You don't need...
So what will happen is it will use a low-cost digital colposcope that can be used in any of these locations that's battery-operated, takes high-quality images, looks like a big smartphone with a handle. It also has the device that you can attach to it to actually do the ablation of the cervix. It's called the Iris, and it'll have the software, this automated visual evaluation software, deployed on it. So all we will need in these situations, and Canada can be included in these types of this type of screening as well, and I think it'll come here. It's not just for low resource settings, but it'll be an HPV genotype that gets entered into the software on that particular woman, and then apply acetic acid to the cervix, and it'll take a series of rapid fire images, and you know if this woman needs to have ablative treatment, if it's normal, or if it's in that gray zone indeterminate phase where you would opt for treatment anyway if you see a lesion, because that woman may not come back to that clinic.
I mean, that's humbling to hear that you know your team has achieved so much. Tell me something about the generational impact of this work in Tanzania and other kind of developing countries.
Sure. Yeah. Well, doing this work is hard. We've screened about 8,000 women in Tanzania, so that's getting an HPV genotype, getting the result back to the woman, navigating those who are positive back in for high quality VIA triage, doing the images, taking the biopsies, which we train nurses to do, and then treating any lesions. And then following those women up again at 12 months, if they've received treatment, if they're HIV positive, or if they and if they had a high-risk genotype. So this is a massive project, and that's just Tanzania and our team, which is, you know, about 8 or 9 people, is just one country out of 9 countries globally that collected this data. This data, what we've shown, not just to train the AI, but what we've been able to show in multiple epidemiological sub-studies that we've done in Tanzania. So we tested, we got reagents for HPV 35, which is also cancer-causing and not in the current vaccines, and very common in African women and African women who immigrate to North America and other places. So that's going to, that will be changing guidelines and how and ideally lobbying vaccine manufacturers to include HPV 35. We've had, we purposely oversampled women living with HIV so that, because they are the highest risk women. So we recruited not only in community health centers, but through HIV clinics. And we've been able, because we chose as a team to do both biopsies of both the canal of the cervix and the outside layer of the cervix, we've generated incredible new data on the burden of disease that's hidden in the cervix, in the os, the opening of the cervix, in women living with HIV who are HPV 16, 18, and 45 positive. This will change guidelines. This was unknown before. And now we're doing a follow-up study where we're going to be able to test the AI and in what we're calling an effectiveness phase. But in that follow-up study, we're generating new data never before generated on persistent, or what we call residual disease, in women who are 16, HPV 16, 18, 45 positive, living with HIV, who've received treatment or had a normal cervix at the time of their first screening. This will also change follow-up guidelines. So the study itself, to be part of the consortium, be part of PAVE, to collect, crowdsource that data for the AI was one part. But all the wraparound work I've done with my amazing colleagues in Tanzania who are cervical cancer scientists, gynecologists, pathologists, the head of the national program, Dr. Safina Yuma, who's helped us so much to be able to implement this work and provided support to bring down barriers in our way. All the nurses and the people we've trained and our team that we work with, it's not done alone. And my PhD student from the translational medicine program did 2 what I call wraparound implementation trials. While we were implementing the PAVE study, she did a randomized control trial, cluster randomized in 30 communities, looking at the most effective strategy for how to recruit women to do an HPV test. She looked at group recruitment, individual recruitment, and then those women that had the HPV test were navigated in the follow-up phase into what we call the patient navigation trial. And this was a one-to-one individually randomized trial where we would send text messages to women as reminders to follow up, where nurses would call them and navigate them. We looked at individual strategies and a combination of strategies, and we're doing the analysis on that, final analysis right now on that data. And that will inform how countries like Tanzania can recruit women for HPV testing and not lose them to follow up, which is the biggest challenge in these countries.
That's very cool. So now I'm going to get you to distill that science and artificial intelligence to a simple message for high school students. So if you were talking to a bunch of boys and girls in a high school class, what would be your message about cervical cancer and HPV?
So this AI algorithm, this automated visual evaluation algorithm, is actually a really, really nice example of how AI works, right? If you think about in the medical field and in screening, right? They screen CT scans to look for lung cancer, and they can use AI to do that. So in this case, we knew, not me, all the scientists, the virologists plus the AI scientists, they knew what we would need to validate this algorithm. They knew how predictive the HPV genotype was. They knew that they would need what's called ground truth, which is actual tissue histopathology, so that the AI doesn't have to, it sees so many of ground truth on this image of this cervix infected with this type of HPV that it trains itself to know when there's disease there or when there isn't. So all of those components together really give you a really nice picture of the components you need to have the proper data set to be able to train AI to do something like cervical cancer screening, which is image-based. Right, so that's a good example of that. And similarly, you know, if you were developing AI for screening the back of the eye for what we call retinopathy for diabetes, you would need thousands and thousands of images of the back of the eye in people who have type 1 or type 2 diabetes. And then you would also potentially need follow-up imaging after you've done certain treatment to, on certain parts of the eye to be able to know, okay, this is what this problem was that was corresponding to this image. So you have to train the AI on what is the main truth, the gold standard, and knowing what the diagnosis is. It can't, you can't guess. You can't take a series. People have tried, and they've tried to sell it this way. Can't take a series of cervical images, because we had over 100,000 of them in our image bank. You can't take those and train an AI. You need the biopsy, and then the positive predictive value of knowing the HPV type is even strengthens your ability to be able to do that.
So basically, you feed all this data into the computer, and if you didn't tell it what to look for, that would be what we call unsupervised learning.
Exactly.
Where basically the computer will
garbage
get on
in,
and,
garbage out.
And it could make completely spurious connections. But what you do is you're telling the computer, this is the truth, this is real. And if you ever see anything like real, it could be real as well. And then you're making the computer make connections to the other data,
exactly,
which could be variable.
And you have to train it with this high quality data, what we call ground truth. What is that actual diagnosis?
And before we go on to the next question, I guess one message for boys and girls, certainly including boys, is they should get vaccinated because, yeah. I mean, the reality is that we live in a crazy world where there are people that don't believe in the values of vaccines, which are the major advance in medicine, full stop, that's been made in the last century. But you can get rid of cervical cancer if you vaccinate both boys and girls.
Yes.
It would essentially disappear over a period of...
It will. And I guess that's one important takeaway point is that just like in Canada and the U.S., young people, teenagers around age 12 or 13 are offered HPV vaccination. This is called primary prevention. That means if that vaccine has 9 or 10 or 11 of the HPV high-risk types, then that young woman will not develop cervical cancer in her lifetime. And a young man won't be able to spread that HPV to a woman or their partner. So that's called primary prevention. Tanzania and many countries have very robust primary prevention programs where they're vaccinating 9 to 13 or 9 to 14-year-old girls. They can afford to vaccinate the girls. They're not vaccinating the boys yet. That's a matter of funding and priorities. What we're doing with our program, with the AI, the HPV testing, and the using the imaging and the AI, and then treating any precancerous lesions to avoid them from becoming cancer, that's secondary prevention. So if you look at the World Health Organization's goal to eliminate cervical cancer by 2030, we're not going to make it. The pandemic slowed us down. If you look at our goal to reach it by 2040, we're still not going to make it for most low and middle income countries. Canada, US, Australia is already pretty much there because they've been vaccinating and doing really high quality HPV testing and screening for a decade before we have been. But in the end, the belief is that in my lifetime, I hope, but maybe a little bit later after I die, there will be this convergence of this population of young women in Tanzania and Kenya and other countries that are vaccinated, are not going to get HPV, are not going to get cervical cancer, and we will have used high quality screening and preventive treatment in their moms and their sisters and their aunties and their grandmas who could not be vaccinated. And those two curves will converge and we'll see a rapid drop in cervical cancer incidence and deaths globally.
I think it's one of those wonderful things where you are genuinely a doctor who's hoping to make herself unemployed.
Yes.
That's like you're going to eliminate the problem that you're working on.
We'll keep you on the nephrology call. Don't worry.
Still lots of work to do.
So every professional has a bump in the road story. Yeah. And I'm very keen to know what your bump in the road might have been or might continue to be.
Yeah. I guess my bump in the road, which you might call it a bump or not, is, and I talked to you guys about this when we talked about this podcast, is that, you know, as a nephrologist and someone who, as a kidney doctor and someone who does research in prevention of kidney disease and wanted to build a successful, legitimate research program that my university and my department and my colleagues would see as worthwhile, I struggled in my own self in my brain and my self-talk on whether someone doing kidney disease prevention research should be doing cervical cancer screening and prevention research. And I, for a number of years, I felt that I needed to either not do it or I needed to find a better way to justify it. Because, you know, as an academic researcher who does clinical work and research, you want to also be able to have some form of collaboration, perhaps with your colleagues. And when I'm going to go collaborate with some gynecologists maybe at Queen's, well, none of them do cervical cancer research. It was these sorts of things. And I felt quite lonely as a researcher on the cervical cancer side of things, and often felt like, I don't know, like, how do I defend this? But then I became so passionate about it because it's a preventable disease. It's something that I could see in the future that this could be something that we could absolutely find a solution for. And I decided just to follow my passion. And in that way, success came, and collaborations and the consortium, but also my other research flourished, funny enough.
So I actually noticed from kind of doing a bit of a background check on you that you're also the co-director of the Office of Global Health now. So hopefully that's helped resolve
correction.
Some of those.
Yeah, correction. I'm actually no longer the director. I was the co-founder of the office, wow. And I did it for 7 years. And then my colleague, Dr. Jen Carpenter, took it over. And then it was within the School of Medicine at Queen's, and then it was kind of subsumed into, I think, one of the other professional development office, and has had different leadership since then. But it was really a place we had a mandate initially to provide really good global health experiences that were safe and appropriate for medical students because they were just figuring out their own. That's how it started. And then we started to build the research program, and we've had a number of learners come over the years, and we've had MPH students from Queen's come and do work specifically even in Tanzania with us. But yeah, I was the co-founder and co-director, and it's morphed into other things now. I think it ultimately became the Kaleidoscope Institute under Jane Philpott, but now it's kind of, I think the pandemic kind of, and fiscal issues have just led to really nothing existing there, unfortunately.
So it's funny, before we go on to the next near final question, I will reveal that I'm Meds 81, so a few hundred miles before you, but we were sent out around the world fairly randomly. Dr. Brian was instrumental in me going to Kenya, and I went to Kenya and worked in Kenyatta National Hospital, and the only thing I learned was I knew absolutely nothing, but I came back with that knowledge of how little I knew and how useless I was in that low resource.
You were a medical student?
I was a medical student.
Yeah.
So it was like just, I had very little insight at that stage in my life. I don't have much now, but I just had enough insight to realize, wow, I don't know anything.
That's funny because I'd helped with Dr. Carpenter. We helped develop the pre-departure and post-departure training program for Queen's learners who were going to these low resource settings. And I used to specifically say to the medical students, you know nothing. People will defer to you. They'll turn and look at you as if you know something because you come from Canada. Do not, when you're doing rounds or you're doing your placement at this hospital, do not answer questions unless it's like a relevant question like a physician here would ask you. But do not give a diagnosis or an answer because you don't know anything. And it does happen in these power differentials. But I might add that it's funny, you mentioned KNH, Kenyatta National Hospital. So through the work I do in cervical cancer, I've managed to be part of two incredible NIH grants, you know, from the National Institutes of Health with colleagues at Emory University, which are training young scientists in implementation science, which is the work I do around how do you get a solution out to the population. And we have two NIH grants, and they're both based at KNH. So I've had multiple stakeholder meetings there. I'm going to be there June 13th, meeting with leadership.
Mention my name and they will test.
And they now have a research center there, which is focused on implementation science. So what goes around comes around.
So since you mentioned Kenyatta National Hospital, that reminds me to ask you our crystal ball question. So, and I'm going to focus the crystal ball a little bit on what do you think is going to happen with global health funding in the future, considering that your research perfectly checks all the boxes that are now forbidden for NIH to fund. It's sex and gender, it's
HIV,
it's Africa,
vaccines.
Vaccines. So it's like the quadrifecta of things that are off the legitimate research list. What do you think is that a temporary
It's really blip? Tragic. It's not. I don't think it's going to be that temporary of a blip. I believe in my heart that somehow things will come around, maybe with the next administration, but the dismantling of USAID, the dismantling of global health research programs from the NIH, the dismantling of the PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, all of those, USAID and PEPFAR fund cervical cancer screening in many African countries. And we implement our solutions and our research within those national programs. So those programs have been dismantled. So for instance, we mentioned KNH. We're doing a randomized trial in Kenya looking at navigation of patients to follow up after doing a vaginal self-sample. And the clinics where we were implementing the program in, there was 17 or 18 clinics, one nurse in the screening clinic might be paid through USAID funding and another nurse by PEPFAR funding. Well, that has now disappeared. And we have to figure out how to rework our randomized trial. Where in the health system will we do the screening? And that's part of our meeting that we're having in June.
Yeah, and we could go on, but we won't. But I mean, in addition to being grateful to the United States for the funding they did provide, sort of also realize that in addition to the immorality of sort of removing that funding precipitously, which was how it was done, which is part of the problem. But ironically, you mentioned the screening device potentially coming full circle and maybe becoming a device to diagnose and manage cervical cancer back in North America.
Yeah.
And wouldn't it be ironic if this misguided policy not only hurts people in Tanzania and Kenya, Horn of Africa, but also hurts people in Baltimore and Ottawa? And
absolutely. And I guess through the last little bit of my crystal ball is that I do believe that other countries and organizations internationally will step up, and there will be, like Canada's already announced, they'll have additional, they'll try to fill some of those gaps, but we just don't have the power that the incredible amount of research that the NIH was doing. But I do think it'll improve, and I do believe that our AVE software will be used in Tanzania. I can envision it being used in the health system. Not sure how they're going to do this and have funding to do the HPV testing, but I believe it will come from other governments and from within. And I believe that we'll be able to use it here at home in Canada.
Yeah.
It's sobering to have a guest on whose crystal ball also overlaps perfectly with a bump in the road. So your crystal ball is more bumps in the road, but hopefully you will persist and keep going, because I think that's important.
Keep writing grants.
So I'm going to move on to some slightly more fun, refresh our palates with a slightly more fun questions that we have. So the first one I'm going to run with is, what is your favorite meal? And importantly, can you cook it yourself?
That's an easy one. So I'm a vegetarian. My favorite meal is my Thai red curry that I make with tofu and bok choy and all of the real fresh ingredients. That's the one I make when I have to fly up north. I make three or four amounts of it so I can have it for all my meals. I never tire of it. And my family and my friends say that it's as good as any restaurant. And of course, if I have non-vegetarians coming over for dinner, I'll make it with chicken or shrimp or something else. But that's my go-to.
So as a vegetarian, that's also one of my favorites.
But fresh coconut milk.
Getting the tofu right, that's the hardest part.
Yeah, but it is.
When you've got it,
it in my air fryer, and then I pop it in after I've made made the curry.
Or replace it with chicken.
Yes, exactly.
So what type of music do you like, and can you play any music yourself?
Yeah, so I played piano all through high school and then kind of gave it up, and we don't have a piano anymore. But I probably could still play a few things. I feel like with my music, I like a lot of things. I'm an old soul. I love old 60s, 70s, 80s. I love folk music. I've seen a lot of the old bands. I saw growing up, I went to Pink Floyd, The Who, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. You name it, I probably went. I went with my high school friends. We were really into discovering that music all through high school, and it stayed with me. And my daughter is now an aficionado of that.
That's a good thing to pass along.
Yeah, I'm very jealous, actually, that you've seen Pink Floyd, so that we'll leave that there. So for my next question, if you could time travel, would you go forward in time or would you go back in time?
I'd go back in time. Do I get to go back in time having learned the things I've learned in life as a 55-year-old?
Yep. If you give us some red chili.
Yeah. Yeah, Thai red curry. I will go back in time. And I just thought about this very deeply this weekend, actually, because my mother-in-law is staying with us and she has some health problems. And we were just talking about life. She grew up after World War II in a displaced persons camp in Germany. And she talked about living in the barracks and she cried a bit. And I said to her, it's amazing how much wisdom you have. And I feel like you have it now at age 84 and all the things you've taught me as your daughter-in-law and what you've taught, the kids, her grandkids. I said, but you feel like it's almost like those parts of life are wasted on the young people because we don't understand it when we're younger. And I said to her, there's so many things, I have no regrets, but there are things that I would do differently if I could go back in time mostly to be around loving the people that I love, or, you know, going down specific paths for my own self-love, if you will. But just because you learn those things and you can go back and you can change them. I'm interested in the future, but I'm scared about the future. And I don't think I want to go there in any rapid succession.
So that's why they say youth is wasted on the young. So
exactly.
Charlie stole my question, which shows you there's no honor among podcasters. So I'm going to steal his question. So this is one very important question we ask all our guests, which is, if you were a cartoon character, which one would you be and why?
So I would be Moana, Disney character. I still often listen to the soundtrack in my car on Spotify on my way to work. I love all the music. So I actually, because I knew you sneakily, you told me about this question, but it is Moana. So I picked Moana because she's brave and adventurous. She's curious. She's compassionate. And she's a really good role model for young girls and young women, and someone I always identified with. And I just loved that movie when it came out, and I can still watch it over and over again.
100%. My boys grew up with that film. Yeah. And the idea that that she was restricted by the wave pattern around the island, and you couldn't breach that. And yeah, you obviously in your career, you've not seen these barriers. You've just crashed straight through them to get to the other side.
Yes, I've had a very circuitous path.
So in addition to Moana, are there any scientists who've inspired you over the years?
Yeah, I picked Tu Youyou. Have you ever heard of her?
No.
So Tu Youyou was a young girl in the 1930s in China. She studied pharmacology and Chinese medicine. I've read a book about her, and I had to go look her up again, but I really admire her. So she studied pharmacology and Chinese medicine, and this is at a time when women were really underrepresented in science, and and this is also at a time during the Cultural Revolution in China, where, this is funny enough how things go around and come around, where there was distrust in science, science was being defunded and these sorts of things, just like we're seeing now. Right, with these types of governments that we have in the U.S. And her, and they actually put scientists in jail at that time. But she faced significant gender bias. But in the 1960s and 70s, malaria was killing millions of people worldwide, in China, the global South. There was, and because there was resistance to the
Chloroquine.
Yeah, exactly. So what she did was she studied 2,000 herbal Chinese remedies, and she discovered that the compound from the sweet woodworm, which is known as Artemisia annua, could kill the malaria parasite. And she developed the drug artemisin, which is still today in Tanzania. I've given it to my children. There's no resistance to it. Hmm. It is still the frontline medication for stopping people from dying from malaria. And she was never given credit for her discovery until 2015, when she was given the Nobel Prize in Medicine.
Dr. Yates, on behalf of Dr. Archer and myself, I'd like to thank you for taking time to talk to our audience today about your research. To our listeners, we'd like to thank you for taking time to get to know Dr. Yates. We hope you've enjoyed the show. If you enjoyed this episode or would like to know more about research at Queen's University, or indeed share this podcast, you can search for Time to Talk Science and Medicine wherever you normally look for podcasts. Thank you.